But it's one of the prices I pay for doing that. Let me speak to you on the last bit of this message. So today we reach the end of our series on Esther and what a journey it has been. My personal hope, I guess, is that you now know a lot more about the events that were occurring in the world in the time in which Esther lived, both within Judah and in Susa and throughout the Persian Empire. And what we've seen is that the world in which Esther lived, well, it wasn't a very nice world, was it? There's no way that we could describe Esther's life as being nice. We've seen Esther marry a ruthless king who completely ignored the rights of women. We've seen a king who acted rashly and foolishly and how his actions affected others. We've seen ancient conflicts between tribes and nations reemerge as Haman sought to completely annihilate the Jews. But we've also seen the attacks carried out by the Jews against Haman and against all their enemies who sought to destroy them, resulting in, do you remember how many? 75,000 of their enemies being put to death. Yet at the same time, whilst God has never got a mention in the book, we've seen God constantly at work, working to ensure that his promises to Abraham and to David and to the world and to you and to me would be fulfilled in Jesus. For in saving the Jews from extinction, God ensured that his son would be born, that his son would be born a Jew in the line of King David. In fact, from next week up until Christmas, we'll be taking a look at the promises that God made, promises that would ensure that Jesus would be born so that he might become our king. And because Jesus is our king, this is why Christmas is one of our great Christian festivals, one of two great festivals. And yet Christmas should be a day when all Jews, all descendants of Abraham should celebrate. But sadly, that's not the case. And that's because many Jews do not recognize Jesus as being their Messiah. And so instead of celebrating Christmas and Easter with us, they celebrate lesser festivals, like the festival of Purim. Now, in today's reading, the author of Esther tells us about how the festival of Purim became part of the annual celebrations of the Jews. We've seen how all the other festivals came about, and so there's got to be a description. But sadly, I think that rather than this celebration bringing the Jews closer to God, it is often intended to distract them from their worship of God. And it even gives them reasons to ignore why God chose them to be his people in the first place. In fact, as we'll see when we go to apply today's passage, the festival of Purim potentially encourages some Jews to hate and to destroy their enemies, which is why, to conclude the series concerning us, we will be reminded of how Jesus, the Jew, responded to his enemies and how he expects you and I to respond to our enemies as his subjects. So we're now going to have our reading and listen to Mordecai and the author of Esther as they lay down some of the rules regarding the celebration of the festival of Purim.
Esther chapter 9, reading from verse 20. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent his letters to the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, that they should celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, and as the month when their sorrow was turned to joy, and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote to them to observe the days as days of feasting and joy, and giving presents of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews agreed to continue the celebration they had begun, doing what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast the pur, that is the lot, for their ruin and destruction. But when the plot came to the king's attention, he issued written orders that the evil scheme Haman had devised against the Jews should come back onto his own head, and that he and his sons should be impaled on poles. Therefore, these days were called Purim, from the word pur. Because of everything written in this letter, and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, the Jews took it on themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants, and all who join them, should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation, by every family, and in every province, and in every city. And these days of Purim should never fail to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of these days die out among their descendants. So Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, along with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this second letter concerning Purim. And Mordecai sent letters to all the Jews in the 127 provinces of Xerxes' kingdom, words of goodwill and assurance, to establish these days of Purim at the designated times, as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther had decreed for them, and as they had established for themselves and their descendants in regard to their times of fasting and lamentation. Esther's decree confirmed these regulations about Purim, and it was written down in the records. King Xerxes imposed tribute throughout the empire to its distant shores, and all his acts of power and might, together with a full account of the greatness of Mordecai, whom the king had promoted, are they not written in the book of the annals of the kings of Media and Persia? Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews, and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, the author there assumes that anyone could go and read the annals of the kings of Persia to find out about Mordecai and others, but of course they couldn't. We can't do that because the Greeks came along and destroyed all the records. Otherwise, it would make it much easier to look at this book and say, well, there's Mordecai in the Persian history and there's Esther and etc., but that's not the case. Anyway, let's look at the passage. The author of Esther tells us in verse 20 that after the Jews got relief from Haman and their enemies, Mordecai, as second in charge now to the king, chapter 10, verse 3, used his authority, verse 20, to order every Jew throughout the whole Persian Empire, and there's the Persian Empire, which was quite significant and large, to celebrate Purim each year on the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar, which is our month of March. And he commanded them to celebrate these days to remember how the Jews got relief from their enemies, how their sorrow was turned into joy, and how their mourning was turned into a day of celebration. And how Mordecai commanded that these 2 days were to be a time of feasting, of joy, of giving presents, of food to one another, and of giving gifts to the poor. And so still today, some 2,500 years after this command was given by Mordecai, Jews, even secular Jews, continue to celebrate this festival no matter where they're living. In fact, breakfast time on the cruise, we'd go and choose a table where we would sit with strangers. And one of those times we had two Jewish sisters and we spoke about this topic and other topics at the time. As the author of Esther wrote in verses 27 and 28, from that time on, the Jews took it upon themselves to establish the custom of celebrating this festival, so that without fail, every generation and every family in every city would continue to celebrate the festival. so that what had occurred in Persia would never be forgotten, would never die out. But then as you look at the festival of Purim today, can you remember what Purim means? What were the pure? It says in the passage they were the lots, but they were the pure, they were the dice. And so it's got to be strange, shouldn't it, for the Jewish kids when they ask their parents, so what are we celebrating? Well, we're celebrating the pure. We're celebrating the dice that a guy called Haman cast to consult his gods on what he should do. It's a funny sort of a celebration, isn't it, when it comes to the Jewish people? But what I hope you can see is that the celebration of Purim seems to have little or nothing to do with Yahweh. In fact, Terrell and I, in trying to find worksheets for the children for this series, I then went to Jewish worksheets for Purim. And do you know, out of all the sheets that appeared, not one of them mentioned God once. Not one of them. And it's very telling. They don't seem to recognize God being involved in their deliverance. So if that's the case, then who did the Jews, or who do they look to for the victory? Well, verse 25, we see it was firstly the pagan king, King Xerxes. Why was that? Well, Mordecai says, because the king issued a written order that the evil scheme that Haman had devised to destroy the Jews would be instead used against Haman and against his sons and against his people. And this is why the festival of Purim is seen by many Jews as a celebration of carrying out revenge against their enemies. But also, as we read in the final verses of Easter, the Jews in celebrating Purim also held Mordecai in high esteem regarding the victory. Sadly, Esther never seems to get much of a mention, even though she risked her life. Verse 3, Mordecai had worked for the good of his people, and he had spoken up for the welfare of all the Jews. But as we read in verse 29, Queen Esther was totally behind what Mordecai commanded regarding Purim. For Queen Esther, daughter of Abihail, whose name means my father is mighty, I don't know if there's significance there, I think maybe, along with Mordecai the Jew, both wrote to confirm how and why all Jews living throughout the Persian Empire were to celebrate this festival every year. So that's how the festival of Purim came about for the Jews, a festival that continues 2,500 years on. But then even after winning this great victory over their enemies, that didn't mean that the Jews were then free agents. They were still subject to the Persian emperor. We see that in chapter 10, verse 1. The king of Persia continued to impose tribute, taxes, if you like, on all the people within his empire, and that, of course, included the Jews in Judah. Now, since then, the Jews have introduced at least one other festival since the time of Esther. That festival is, anyone know? Hanukkah, and it's around our Christmas time. So there's a Jewish celebration of Hanukkah, and they celebrate the temple being rededicated to God's service and the coming of the light in 164 BC after the Greeks, headed up by Antiochus Epiphanes IV, had desecrated the temple by placing an altar to Zeus, I think it was Zeus, in the place of the altar to sacrifice to Yahweh. But I'll come back to that later. Personally, I see a problem with the introduction of both of these festivals. Where did the command to celebrate these festivals come from? Humans. Whereas in the book of Exodus, it was God who commanded that every Jewish male go up to the temple four times a year to celebrate what? The Passover, the Day of Atonement, the festival of first fruits, and the festival of booths or tabernacles. So it's quite different. There's no instruction by God here. And God commanded his people to celebrate these four festivals so that God's people would recall and celebrate what God had done in the past and what God was doing in the present for his people. For every Passover, they celebrated God rescuing them from Egypt. At the Festival of Booths, they celebrated God providing for their needs for 40 years in the wilderness and giving them his good and perfect laws. And at the Festival of First Fruits, they celebrated the harvest that God had provided for them that year. We have a harvest. Let us thank God. And on the Day of Atonement, they offered sacrifices to God as they celebrated God atoning for their sins. And really, compared to these four festivals, the Festival of Purim and even the Festival of Hanukkah are nothing in comparison. But firstly, God had not established or commanded his people to celebrate these two festivals. Secondly, Purim doesn't even acknowledge God in delivering his people from their enemies. Mind you, one reason why Jews are keen to celebrate Purim and Hanukkah is because it's a little bit difficult to celebrate the other four festivals nowadays. And why is that? There's no temple. Whereas these festivals, you can celebrate in your own home, anywhere, any place. But then, if it was God who worked behind the scenes to ensure that the Jews were saved from their enemies and from Haman, why hasn't God ensured that there would be a temple for the Jews to celebrate these festivals today? It's one of the questions we come up. As we look at the book of Esther. It's a very good question. And this question also gives me a lead into where I want to conclude this series. But in order to do this, I've got to take you on quite a significant journey, a journey in time up until including, what date is it today? I haven't got my watch on. 23rd of November, the day my dad was born. So a couple of weeks ago, I showed you this slide. On the left is a picture of the kingdom of Israel under King David at its peak. On the right is a picture of the kingdom of Judah, or the land of Judah, in the time of Xerxes. And I showed you this picture where you can see, and in the blue, in the darker grays is during David. You can see there's no comparison, is there? They'd shrunk to little or nothing during the time of Esther. But then what happened in this part of the world after the time of Esther? Well, the history of Judah from that time on wasn't much better than it was before the exile, when God sent his people off as a punishment. Why? Because the Jews on the whole continued to disregard God's laws. And so as part of God's judgment upon them, the Jews were always basically under foreign control. For after the Persians came, Alexander the Great, the Greeks, and the Greeks ruled over Judah until the Maccabees led a revolt, which then made the Jews semi-autonomous. For almost a century, until who conquered the Greeks? The Romans. And Judah came under Roman rule. But then after the Romans came to power, as we see in the days of Jesus, the freedom of the Jews became less and less. They couldn't even kill someone without Rome's authority, for example. And they had to pay their taxes to Rome. Of course, because the Romans were still ruling over Judah when Jesus was born. But then why did God send Jesus? Jesus tells us of his mission in Matthew chapter 5. He said he did not come to earth or to Judah to abolish the law or the prophets. Rather, Jesus came to fulfill them. For Jesus came to fulfill the covenants that God had made with Abraham and with David and their descendants. Which is why on the night before Jesus died, on the eve of the Jewish Passover festival, Jesus took some bread and he said, "This is my body given for you. Do this in remembrance of me." And then he took the cup and said, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you." And of course, elsewhere we read that Jesus is described as being the new temple. There is no need for the old temple, but we'll come back to that. So then through his death, Jesus fulfilled the old covenant that God made with Abraham and his descendants by bringing blessing to all the nations. And then he established a new, and as we read in the book of Hebrews, a better covenant. A covenant that was better because it led to forgiveness once and for all through one sacrifice that led to eternal life. Mind you, the establishment of this new covenant should have come as no surprise to the Jews of Jesus' day, for God had made it clear, very clear to his people through the prophets that he would establish this new and better covenant through a descendant of King David who would rule forever. And one of the reasons why this covenant would be better was because the new covenant would not just benefit the descendants of Abraham, but this new covenant would benefit people from every tribe, language, and nation. I don't know if you remember 6 weeks ago when we began this series, where did we begin? Tower of Babel, where the nations were separated, but God chose Abraham to bring his blessing to all the nations to reverse in some ways the impact of the Tower of Babel. For it is through Jesus, who is a physical descendant of Abraham, through which this universal blessing has come about, a blessing which has reversed in part that separation that occurred at Babel, Babylon. But then if Jesus has established a new covenant for people from every nation, then did Jesus give any promises regarding the Jews or regarding the land of Israel? What did Jesus say about that? Well, he talked about the temple. What did he say would happen to the temple? It would be destroyed. Not one stone would be left upon another. In fact, he promised them nothing but judgment. Look at some of the parables of what Jesus said. There would be weeping, gnashing of teeth, eternal fire for those who rejected him. And we see that when Jesus came to Jerusalem, he wept for Jerusalem. And why did he weep for Jerusalem? Because his people would reject him, their true king, who came to deliver them. And because of this, as we read in Luke chapter 19, verse 43, Jesus warned the Jews and the Christians about a day to come when their enemies would encircle Jerusalem and where the temple would be completely destroyed. That was his promises regarding the physical descendants of Abraham and the temple. Now, this prophecy of Jesus was fulfilled in AD 70, and we looked at it early in the year, because the Romans made war on the Jews, and they destroyed the temple. And this was a time when many Jews were either killed, displaced, so scattered from their land, or, and I didn't know this before, they were sold into slavery. Where had they begun? In Egypt, in slavery. Where did they end up? Many of them in slavery for rejecting their king. And so from that time on, very few, if any, Jews then lived in what was once the land that God had given to them. So see the little blue dot there? After AD 70, basically all gone, not in the land at all. Then, 200 years later, after the Emperor Constantine converted to Christianity, Christendom began, The majority of people who lived in the former land of Judah were Christians. They were Byzantine, whatever Byzantine means, Byzantine Christians. But then in the 7th century AD, the Muslims arose and they conquered the land and controlled it. But then in the 12th and 13th centuries AD came who? The Christians, or the Crusaders. And they took the land back from the Muslims. They killed many, many Muslims, and the Turks haven't forgiven us for that. But they also killed many Jews in Jerusalem. So there were some Jews in Jerusalem, but the Crusaders killed many of them. And you'll see that a little bit later in a T-shirt. Soon after that came, surprised me, the Mongols, and they took the land. Then the Mamluks, who they were. Then the people we're most familiar with in our history, the Ottomans, the Turks. And the Turks held the land until they lost it to the Brits during World War I at the Battle of Beersheba. Yeah. So some people know their history better than me, that's for sure. Mind you, prior to World War I, other things were afoot. Near the end of the 19th century, so the 1880s, 1890s, saw the rise of a secular, so a non-religious Jewish national movement in Europe, known as Zionism. And Zionists wanted to see Jews return to the former lands of Israel. I don't know why, but they did. And so Jewish immigration to what was then the land of the Palestinians, it began to increase. There was some support for that going on. Then during World War I, when the Brits gained control of the land, the British government then committed itself publicly to the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine in, anyone know, 1970-something declaration? Balfour Declaration. And here's a copy of it. You can't read it from there, but you can look it up on the internet. I'll read you part of it. It's announcing support for a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. Mind you, this is during the war. It was also a military tactic. They needed allies, and the Jews were everywhere, so they sought to garner support to get the Jews on their side. Now, whilst the increase in migration of Jews to Palestine that followed this declaration caused tensions between Palestinians and Jews, the Palestinians held almost all of the land, as you can see in this first map. So the white bits are the Jews, the Israelis, and the green bits, the majority is Palestinians. But then World War II came along, and something else was going on in World War II, which was the Nazi Holocaust. How many Jews died? 6 million. And so after that, the United Nations voted to create a Jewish and an Arab state within Palestine, as shown in this second map. So that was the plan. It wasn't enacted like that. That was the plan. Who loses out on that one? Palestinians, because their land shrunk dramatically at that point. They've still got half of Jerusalem, but certainly not all of it, and they've lost a lot of the land, and Galilee was such a rich, fertile place. You can see they lost that, the best land for growing food. And whilst the Jews who hadn't lived on this land for the previous 1900 years accepted the plan, the Arabs, not unsurprisingly, rejected it. So civil war broke out. And in the civil war that followed, more than 700,000 Palestinian Arabs, about of half of Palestine's predominantly Arab population, were either killed, of course, it's a war, or expelled from the land, or fled from their homes, as per this next map. So you've got the United Nations plan in the centre. Now on the right, what happens after the Civil War? Further reduction. And yet despite, it's a sort of a two-state plan, isn't it, that map? within Palestine. This taking of the land by the Jews has continued since then, as can be seen in this final map. So that's what it's like sort of currently today. Very different to the first one, isn't it? So what was once a form of a state, two-state solution, a petition that was made between Palestinians and Jews, is now no more. In fact, today, more than 600,000 Jews live in the West Bank. So the West Bank is the West Bank of the Jordan River, so the area on the right. So where the green is in the third map, that's the West Bank, but you can see much, much of it is white now. To keep them in their place, I think it's the Jews, there's sort of the map. They've built a wall, and if you can see a red dotted line in that, that's the wall. It doesn't go all the way from sea to sea, but it is patrolled by Israeli military. In Bethlehem, Melita and I went there. To get from Bethlehem, you've got to go from Israel to Palestine. In going from Israel to Palestine, you've got to go through that wall. An Israeli soldier or two will hop on your bus with his machine gun, and it's a frightening place to be. But what does that wall look like to you? Looks like a prison wall, yes. Mind you, our United Nations Security Council has repeatedly affirmed that Israeli settlements in Palestinian territory are a, quote, flagrant violation of international law. Our International Court of Justice has declared that the establishment of Israeli settlements in the West Bank is illegal under international law. But to date, I'm not aware of any action that's been taken against Israel. Of course, that's just one of the reasons why in 1987, so 40 years after that civil war, an organisation was formed called, anyone want to guess, in our news, Hamas, 40 years after this happened. Since its formation, Hamas has called on members of the two Abrahamic faiths, who's that? The Jews and the Christians, to accept Islamic rule in the Middle East, in Palestine. And of course, Hamas are willing to do almost anything to bring this about. So when they first formed their constitution, Article 31 of their constitution read, under the wing of Islam, it is possible for the followers of the three religions, so Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, to coexist in peace and quiet with each other. But then they add, it is the duty of the followers of other religions to stop disputing the sovereignty of Islam in this region, because the days these followers should take over, there will be nothing but carnage, displacement, and terror. That's what we're seeing in Palestine today, isn't it? As followers of religions other than Islam have further encroached on the lands that were assigned to the Palestinians by our United Nations in 1947. Now, of course, the Jews and the Israelis have a very different take on all this to Hamas. And so when Hamas attacked Israel in 2023, the Jews then attacked Palestine. How many Jews died in those attacks? 1,200. How many Palestinians have died since this war began? 70,000 is the estimate now. How many died in the days of Esther? 75,000. Very, very similar. And I think that's significant. So why have Israel's attacks on Palestine been so severe? Well, let's go back to near the start of the war to October 2023. Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, said, The Israeli government is committed to completely eliminating this evil from the world. Further to this, he stated, and you've got to listen for the word, you must remember what Amalek has done to you, says your holy Bible. And we do remember. Who is Amalek? Haman's mom. Amalekites. So one of the places that Netanyahu would have got this was from the book of Esther. Because for the Jews, the festival of Purim is a continuing reminder of how the Jews completely wiped out Haman and his people who happened to be Amalekites. But we've also got to look at the book of, I think it's Exodus, where God made a judgment there as well. So Netanyahu makes that claim, the bombs start happening. And so the International Court of Justice chose to meet, and they met in South Africa in December 2023, 2 months after that. And they, the International Court, made allegations against Israel of seeking to commit genocide in their attacks upon Gaza. So not just Hamas, but genocide, that was the attack. But Netanyahu denied that this was his intention. And then following the hearings, Netanyahu's office issued a statement which included, the comparison to Amalek has been used throughout the ages to designate those people who seek to eradicate the Jewish people, most recently the Nazis. Prime Minister Netanyahu's reference to Amalek was not an incitement to genocide of Palestinians, but a description of the utterly evil actions permitted by the genocidal terrorists of Hamas and the need to confront them. I've tried to be as objective as I can, but I'll leave it to you to decide what you think about all this in the world in which we live. This T-shirt, I saw one live in near the border of Lebanon in Israel. There's the T-shirt. While you're straining to see it, let me read it to you. Civilizations, nations, and empires that have tried to destroy the Jewish people. Ancient Egypt, gone. Philistines, gone. Syrians, gone. Babylonians, gone. Persians, even though they praise Xerxes, gone. Greeks, gone. Romans, gone. Byzantines, the Christians, gone. Crusaders, gone. Spanish, gone. Nazis, gone. Soviet Union, gone. And Iran, can you see the marks there? Three question marks. We'll see. And so the conclusion says, the Jewish people, the smallest of nations, but with a friend in the highest of places. So be nice. I think you can see how some Jews have used the Festival of Purim to justify some of their actions in Gaza and against other countries that have attacked them, countries like Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. In fact, as in the days of Esther, most of Israel's neighbours today would love nothing more than to see Israel completely wiped out. They're totally surrounded. So this is a difficult one for us. It's no wonder that our Prime Minister has a differences to the President of the United States on what should be done there. It's no wonder that Christians through the world have different opinions. It's no wonder that Christians in this congregation have different opinions on what should be done there. Mind you, destroying their enemies was just one of the responses by Jews to what happened in Persia in those days in Esther. I think, from reading the biblical evidence, that another response taken by Jews at that time was to see their God as the one who delivered them from their annihilation. I say that because a spiritual revival occurred. I told you a couple of weeks ago, Ezra was living where? Babylon. What's he doing there, Babylon? What's he do for a job? He's a priest. How can you be a priest at the temple if you're in Babylon? But 15 years, I think it's 15 years after the events in Esther, Ezra becomes a teacher of the law. They're studying the law. And so Ezra returns to, let me show the map, first arrow. Ezra returns, temple's rebuilt, to Israel and starts teaching the law, bringing about a spiritual revival in the land. Then came another guy in our Bibles called Nehemiah. And he was living where? Susa, where Xerxes, Esther were living. And he also, when we know that he was a man of faith, the second arrow, who prayed before Yahweh, the God of heaven. So we see a change come about than what we see at the start of the book of Esther. Something like a spiritual revival. So that's the history of the land of Israel up to today, and the responses made by Jews in the days, in the years after the events that are described in Esther. In the minutes that I have remaining, and some of you say, well, you've got no time left, I think that we have to look at our Christian response to the book of Esther. We have to look at our king. We have to look at what he tells us to do, which is quite different to what we see others doing. In Jesus, who is the rightful king of the Jews, we see a very different response made by a Jew towards his enemies than that of Mordecai and Esther. For as we know, Jesus forgave his enemies. And that's wonderful for us. And why is that wonderful for us? Because you and I were his enemies. Make no mistake, you and I were his enemies. We had sinned against God. We were at enmity with his Father. We were his enemies. But not only did Jesus forgive us, Jesus took the punishment that you and I deserved for being God's enemies upon himself. For in Jesus, as we sing in one of the songs, the wrath of God was satisfied. And through his death, Jesus then established that new and better covenant that we now celebrate. And so as his people living under this new covenant, what's Jesus call us upon to do? Somebody slaps you in the face. What do? Turn the other cheek. Very different to the book of Esther, isn't it? What are we to do for our enemies? We are to love our enemies. What are we to do for those who persecute us? We are to pray for them, says Jesus. In fact, Jesus calls upon us to, it's one of the hardest words for an Australian, to deny ourselves. He tells us to take up our cross, to give our lives, lay down our lives to follow him. For as Jesus submitted to the authorities of his day, many of whom were his enemies, and he submitted even to death, so we are to submit to the authorities of our day. Why? Well, who placed Xerxes on the throne in Persia? God did. Who placed the rulers of the nations on their thrones today? God did. What's Paul say about that? We're to submit to those in authority over us. Sometimes, like Jesus, that will mean we will die for what we believe in. But we remember that God is in control. And so whilst we may live in a world that's very much like the world of Esther, so a world that on the whole ignores God, a world which oppresses people and Christians, Jesus calls on us to leave the actions of those who hurt us to him to deal with. I will repay, says the Lord. And whilst we will struggle with this, we know that Jesus has set the example, and we know that Jesus will be with us in this. But we also know, and I think sadly, you may not think, that our sovereign Lord Yahweh has set the day on which he will pour out his wrath upon those who hate us and who hate him. That's his position as the only righteous and holy God. But till then, our job is to win our enemies over to him like Jesus did for us. And the book of Esther gives us confidence to do this. For in the book of Esther, we see God actively at work in his world, setting things in place in ways that we could never even imagine, so as to bring about his will and his desires for his people. I think Karen Jobes, in trying to summarize this whole book, wrote, through his inscrutable way, and I've forgotten what the word means, through his inscrutable way, along paths that are sometimes dark and treacherous, God brings his people to that day when all creation will rejoice that our sorrow has been turned into joy and our mourning into celebration. This is the time in which we live, a time very much like the time of Esther. And so let us live our lives at such a time as this, not taking revenge, but following the example that our King has set for us and has commanded for us. Because it was whilst you and I were his enemies that our Jesus, our King, chose to die to save us. Let me pray. Heavenly Father, we live in a world where we often wonder where you are at work. As we look at the disasters and the wars and other things, we sometimes question your goodness and your sovereignty. But in Esther, we are reminded that you are in control of all things, that you placed a Jewish queen on the throne of Persia for such a time as when Haman chose to try to eliminate all those descendants of Abraham, to take away the promises that a Jew would be born in the line of David, who would become king and who would rule all the nations and who would bring in everlasting peace. Help us to remember what you have done in the past so that we may live our lives in confidence in you in the present, so that we may turn the other cheek, so that we may love those who hate us, so that we may pray for those who persecute us, that we may deny ourselves and follow your example by taking up our cross. And we pray this in Jesus' name. I had a few people falling asleep in the first half of that sermon at the 8 o'clock. Didn't notice it so much here, but anyway, there we've gone.